versus weighing yourself like at the top of the Sears Tower, you're going to weigh a little bit less, just a little bit less, because you're a little bit further away from the gravitational center of the universe. It's the way physics is. Guess what? Physics is a lot like life. The closer, and I'm speaking sort of metaphorically here, so hang with me. The closer you get to a way of acting, a way of being, the stronger its pull is upon you. And by closer, I mean the more often you start doing something, the stronger its pull upon you, the easier it is to do it. So you do something once, it makes it easier to do something twice. You do something twice, it makes it easier to form a habit. And after a while, you are drawn in. And other times, experiments become habits, and those habits become inclinations. In this life, I would like to argue at the beginning of this sermon that there are two inclinations that you and I are most susceptible to, and we didn't even think about it if we go there. And those two inclinations are idleness and drivenness. Idleness is that listlessness, that thing we might associate with laziness, but it's not just not doing anything. It may just be a life full of diversion and distraction that amounts to you're doing pretty much nothing. No focus. It's just you're all over the place. That's idleness. And then there's that other inexplicable, nearly inexplicable compulsion to be just full of activity and just totally busy and always energized and always moving in some forward way. And we call that compulsion drivenness. And for some people, it's sort of like a cycle. I read an article this week from a pastor who says, you know, for pastors and others, you can get lazy for a while, and what does that then prompt you to become? Driven, so that you can make up for all the time you've wasted while being lazy. And then once you've been committing yourself to drivenness for so long, what do you want to do? Nothing! So you're caught in this loop, this negative loop, and it starts to be a downward spiral. That's the inclinations, the gravitational pulls to which you and I are drawn to. And you're thinking, what in the world does this have to do with the Apostles' Creed? Those of you that are just joining us, we are in the very last sermon of a series listening to the Apostles' Creed to kind of guide us into what are the very elements of our belief. What are the very foundations of what it is to hold to Jesus as Lord, and that God has come in human flesh to reclaim all that was His and to make all things new. We end where the creed ends, with where it says, I believe in the resurrection of the body and the life everlasting. Amen. What does that mean? Now, you and I, as we said at the very beginning of the worship service, to just consider that doctrine, you and I immediately think that the doctrine's relevance is our consolation in death. And you are right! I'm not trying to dismiss that. But I would like to argue this morning that it has greater relevance than just when you're on your deathbed or when somebody you love is on their deathbed. If it doesn't, is it possible that we've missed something crucial about our understanding of that doctrine? After Easter, we're going to spend 6 or 7 weeks in one chapter of the Bible, 1 Corinthians 15, which spends a lot of time, Paul, just talking about resurrection. This morning, we're going to listen to a very short word of Jesus about resurrection, and listen for three things in that short passage: the case for it, the linchpin to it, and the implications of it, implications for now, this life, and maybe implications for the two inclinations I spoke of at the beginning of this introduction. So, we're in the Gospel of Mark. We're in chapter 12. We'll start in verse 18. If you would do his word honor by standing and listening. Mark chapter 12, starting in verse 18. And Sadducees came to him who say that there is no resurrection. And they asked him a question, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but leaves no child, the man must take the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. There were 7 brothers. The first took a wife, and when he died, left no offspring. And the second took her and died, leaving no offspring. And the third likewise. And the 7 left no offspring. Last of all, the woman also died. In the resurrection, when they rise again, whose wife will she be for the 7 that had her as a wife? And Jesus said to them,
is this not the reason you are wrong? Because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but they're like angels in heaven. And as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses how God spoke to him saying, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are quite wrong. That's the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Let's have a seat. All right. Have you ever seen one of those speed chess tournaments? It's amazing. Like, I don't know how people's minds work like that. Like, it's like one person that is surrounded by a circle of 12 different like chess games, and that person goes from board to board and makes a move with every one of that board's opponents. And somehow they win or lose, whatever it might be. And because everybody comes at that player with their own strategy, their own wisdom on how to eventually get a checkmate. And so the person going around is trying to, you know, make moves. They're all wise and strategic and things like that. That's what, in a sense, you see Jesus here in this moment in the Gospel of Mark. He is up against several opponents, if you will, each one of them with their own strategy to take him down and enforce their own version of checkmate upon his life, his ministry, his credibility. And so here in the passage that we just read, it's sort of immersed in a series of one-offs with different authorities. One scribe and Pharisee start to question Jesus's authority, and then Jesus tells a parable. And then in the passage after that, some Pharisees and Herodians come up to Jesus and start trying to quiz him on the balance between divine sovereignty and human authority. And then later in this sort of round of speed chess, somebody comes up to him, not so much in an antagonistic way, but really to make an inquiry, like, Jesus, if you could summarize the law in 50 words or less, what would you say? It's that kind of situation he's in. And every single one of these is happening inside the temple courts. So there's something at stake here in every answer that he gives, because he's either going to gain credibility or lose credibility depending on the answer that he gives. And so here in our passage, he's approached by these guys called the Sadducees. Now, who are they? We don't know much. We know a little. Any documents or writings about the Sadducees are lost to us in antiquity. What we do know, at least a little bit, is they were believers in God. They kind of preferred to align themselves with the more politically inclined. So they're kind of like Episcopalians, right? I'm sorry. Don't take that. I have lots of Episcopalian friends. They're friends of mine. I'm sorry I said that. As opposed to their Pharisee compartment, Pharisee compatriots. The Pharisees preferred to keep a nice division of power between the king and the priesthood and the law. The Sadducees said, you know what? We can be more efficient if we kind of, you know, swap stories and compare notes about how to organize the people if we bring together the government and the priesthood under one roof. That's kind of where the Sadducees are. But something else that's true of the Sadducees is what you hear Mark refer to them as when he says, they believe that there is no resurrection. Now, they are not to be confused with the people of our day that we would call materialists, which are not people that like to accrue a lot of money, but are people that believe the only real thing in the universe is matter. There is no spirit. There is no supernatural. Everything that is has an explainable cause, even if we can't yet explain it. Therefore, resurrection would be off the map, off the radar, off the table, because they're materialists. That's not exactly what the Sadducees are, because they believe in God. Why don't they believe in the resurrection? Because their source of authority is confined to the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the Torah. That's their Bible. Anything beyond that is speculative reasoning, speculative theologizing. And if you go from Genesis to the end of Deuteronomy, if you're looking for real explicit promises that there will be a resurrection from the dead, don't hold your breath. Because at most, there will be hints. But for the lion's share, if not exclusively, all you're going to hear is the expectation that when you die, that is it. That, the Torah, is the Sadducees' canon. All right, underscore that word in your mind because we're going to refer to it a lot in this sermon. What do we mean by canon? What is culture in the midst of right now? A big debate over what should be included in the literary canon, the Western canon. In other words, what are the books and stories and writings and authors that we should be teaching to our children always and everywhere from now and forever? Amen. That's the canon. That compendium of sources that we would want to appeal to form us, to shape us, to guide us. A canon has that authority over us. The Torah, for the Sadducees, was their canon. They appealed to it to interpret their world. And I bring that up for you to make this sort of meditative point that we're going to come back to later. Everybody in this room and everybody in this world has a canon. Now, most of you in this room, if I pressed you, what's your canon? You would say the Bible. And I wouldn't doubt you on that. I would have no reason to be suspicious of your claim. But there are other things that enter into your canon. And we're going to tease a little bit of that out as we go along here. But everybody's got a canon. Everybody's got a set of ideas and assumptions and presuppositions through which you interpret your world. And the Sadducees do the same. And the Sadducees do that with Jesus. They appeal to their canon to put a question before him. Now, what they're doing, we all know, and you could probably tell by the tone of voice that I took to characterize the Sadducees, that what they're doing is pretty disingenuous. They knew the answer to their own question. The reason they're asking it is not because they're actually entertaining an alternative to their belief. They're asking it because they want to show Jesus to be without credit, without credibility. And so, yes, it is a question, but it's a setup. It's a setup to show him foolish. How do they try to do that? They raise a theological conundrum that makes Jesus' belief in the resurrection, in their minds, to be utterly stupid. And how do they do that? They whip up this little scenario that you heard. That's grounded in the law in Deuteronomy 35, where it speaks of what happens if you marry a woman and that husband dies, but the husband has brothers. What's the responsibility of his brothers? And that responsibility, we call Levirate marriage, is for one of the brothers to take that woman, that widow, as to help continue the line of his dead brother. And so the Sadducees put forth this outlandish scenario that seven brothers, all of them die. None of them produce an offspring. And then she dies. So whose husband is she, Jesus? And whose wife is she, Jesus, in the resurrection? You ever heard that song, "I Am My Own Grandpa"? Right? Oh, so you have, right? Yeah, it's like a theoretical possibility that you could actually enter into a marriage where your father was still alive and your father married the adult daughter of the woman you marry. And in that circumstance, if you lay out the family tree, you become your own grandfather. What do you give yourself then? I don't know. But that's the story. And I'll put a link up this week that actually shows the family tree. It's fantastic. It's that kind of outlandish situation that the Sadducees are trying to create in Jesus' mind to see if they can catch him in a contradiction. It's this improbable situation that would suggest to everybody that's hearing that if in fact God is going to rise people from the dead, then God is going to back himself into a corner because we know that God is not authorizing multiple marriages. So if the resurrection is true, is that therefore making God contradict his own law? That's where the Sadducees are. That's where they're trying to put Jesus in a bad light. That's their argument from their canon, the Torah. Here's why I mention canon in yours and my world, though. I know that most of the time, the way you live your lives, the things that you give yourself to every day, you are most likely not very often thinking about the doctrine of the resurrection. Feeding your kids, paying your taxes, picking up your dry cleaning. I'm doubtful that when you plunk over your credit card to pay for the medium starch that you're thinking, "I'm so glad that though you die, yet shall you live." When does that come into play? When you bury a kid, when you bury a friend, when you bury a parent, guess what? The relevance of that doctrine comes flooding in. But here's the thing, brothers and sisters. I know and you know that in moments of great sorrow and great disorientation, that those moments foist upon us, you know what happens? It's not surprising that we start to feel somewhere in us like where the Sadducees land on resurrection. We think, I want to believe it, but I don't know that I can. To their credit, the Sadducees are at least asking questions in line with their convictions. To your credit, I think it is worth all of us from time to time to have coffee with our inner Sadducee. Or maybe to put it a little bit a more modern way, to have coffee with our inner atheist. Now, the doctrine of resurrection may be something that you never question, and that's fine. I'm not projecting upon you that possibility. But if ever that is a struggle for you, you ought not sort of silence that voice in you. You ought to bring it out into the open, if only so that you can come to terms with what you think discounts the possibility of resurrection. You should have coffee from time to time with your inner atheist. For reasons I hope to make clear. Because when you are faced with death, what comes to mind at times? You may never have seen a resurrection. You may never heard anybody talk about a resurrection. And therefore, what do you conclude? The doctrine of resurrection, that's just a hope, but not a reason to believe it. Or you may think, you know what? There's a lot of faith traditions out there. And every one of them has this aim in common, that they all hold to certain supernatural events that kind of bind them together and say, this is why we believe. And all of that, a lot of those faith traditions emerged and formed in antiquity. And you think, you know what? The whole doctrine of the resurrection, that also kind of was shaped in antiquity. So if all of those supernatural claims are not verifiable, then why would I think that the resurrection is verifiable? So maybe there's no resurrection. See, these are the thoughts of your inner atheist. And these are thoughts, brothers and sisters, of the canon that you bring to that question. The Sadducees brought theirs, you bring yours, and though you may have different reasons, you may come up with the same conclusions. So what do you do with that? What do you do with your inner atheist? You listen to Jesus' argument. What is Jesus' argument with the Sadducees? His case is this. Sadducees, you're wrong. Like, there's only one time in all of the Gospels in which Jesus says to someone, you're wrong. And it's this moment, and he says it twice. Are you not wrong, he says. Oh, you are wrong, between verses 24 and 27. How are they wrong? The Sadducees think that resurrection is, first of all, mostly and merely, if not exclusively, about reanimating dead people. And Jesus says, Sadducees, resurrection is about a lot more than that. Resurrection is about the transformation of all things. Scripture begins and ends with a wedding. For this reason, a man shall leave his mother and father and cling to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And at the end of Revelation, what do we have? The marriage supper of the Lamb. When Jesus makes all things new, when God makes things all new in Jesus, that includes how we relate to people. Marriage provided a pointer of how God is full of provision, how God is full of love for those who come to Him. And Jesus is a picture of marriage, or rather, marriage is a picture of Christ's love for the church. And yet Jesus is saying that marriage's point has been fulfilled. Everything changes in the resurrection. But the greater point that Jesus is making, the greater argument of his case for resurrection, Jesus actually appeals to the Sadducees' canon. He doesn't go to Daniel. He doesn't go to the Psalms. He doesn't go to the minor prophets. He doesn't go to Ezekiel. He goes to Exodus. He goes to Exodus 3. Remember that bush story? On fire, not consumed. And what happens in that moment? God introduces himself to Moses and says, not I was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God says to Moses, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why does Jesus bring that forward? Why does Jesus bring out that very simple line of syntax in choice of verb tense? The Lord makes promises and covenants of provision and protection. Why, Jesus implies by his question, would you assume that God would be bound by physical death to keep from being able to keep other promises? The Lord births, sustains a people in ways that no one can explain apart from his hand. Why then would God not be able to bring life to a people who have been lost to him in death? God is not bound by death. He is still in relationship with those whose bodies have died. So why do you assume that he can't restore life in bodily form? That's his implication by bringing forth that story from their canon. Now, to us, that's mind-boggling, and we probably have to ask the question, how is his argument to the Sadducees sort of an argument to us? To them, he's making the argument, Sadducees, look, if God is able to preserve relationship with the dead, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If he's able to preserve that relationship with them, why do you think he's unable to restore them to bodily form and bodily life? To us, maybe he scales the question a little bit differently. Brothers and sisters of the 21st century, if he is able to bring all of this into existence, to bring all of you into life, why is he unable, do you think, to be able to restore you to life even after you die? See, to the Sadducees and to us, Jesus is making this sort of two-prong argument. Your canon, it's too narrow. And the canon you're listening to, you're not really listening to it as well as you should. What do I mean by that? To our inner atheist, Jesus is saying, if you think that your personal experience is sufficiently comprehensive for you to determine whether or not there is resurrection, your canon is too narrow. It's too narrow. You don't know. And secondly, if you think that the reason we believe in something so outlandish as resurrection is because that belief came from a time when just everybody always believed in the supernatural, you're applying logic to your thinking. But you're not applying it enough. You're not listening to the logic of your canon enough. Because look, think about Joseph for a second. I've said this illustration before. It's not mine. It's from C.S. Lewis. But you and I know that Mary's husband, or soon-to-be husband Joseph, when he first hears that she's pregnant, his first words are, what shall we name him? His first words are, I'm sorry. We're done. I'm not going to make you look bad, but I'll let you go away quietly. Why? Because when she said that she was pregnant, his first thought was not that she was telling the truth, but that she was not telling the whole truth. The supernatural explainability was not his first thought. At the end of Jesus' earthly ministry, it says at the end of Matthew's gospel, when they were following him to the mount before he ascends, some believed, but some doubted. Doesn't sound like everybody has an itchy trigger finger when it comes to believing supernatural events, does it? So listen, if you want to employ logic in your canon, fine. Just listen to it with greater fullness. Your canon's too narrow, or you're not listening to your canon enough. All right, brothers and sisters, that was the longest point. The rest of the points will be shorter. But that's the case that Jesus makes for resurrection. And in making that case, he is saying this. Resurrection is not just about reanimating life. Resurrection is all about showing us the glory of life, the good of life, the beauty of life. That's what resurrection is about. And that's the case that Jesus makes. But that's not his whole case, and you know it. Because yes, he's just made an argument to the Sadducees, but he's about to become the argument. And so when I get here, my second point, I'm trying to say this. Jesus has claimed thus far that resurrection is a valid belief. But what he's about to do in a few days is go first to validate that belief. He's agreeing that there are hints in the Hebrew Bible that is more than just a rhetorical flourish when it comes to resurrection. But now, he's not only saying the resurrection's going to happen, his own life will make the case that resurrection is true, and therefore Jesus is about to make the argument that he not only believes in resurrection, but that he's the linchpin to it. That Jesus is the linchpin to resurrection. He dies, he's risen, not just to prove that God has power over death, though if that's all he was out to prove, that would be fine. He's out to prove and to show that resurrection is not just about reanimating life. Resurrection and life everlasting rests irreducibly on reconciliation. It's not just you wake up again. It's that you wake up to being reconciled to God. And what that means implicitly is that resurrection is not so much about your life, but about your life in relationship with God and without stain and without estrangement and without alienation. Resurrection rests on reconciliation, which means resurrection has everything to do with relationship with God. So what? So it is. Jesus is the linchpin to resurrection, and that's how you're to think about resurrection, reconciliation, and relationship. What then, to get to where we began this sermon, what are the implications of resurrection seen in that light? The Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich said, "I think that if people began thinking about death sooner, they'd make fewer foolish mistakes." And we all nod our heads. That's true. The more we think about death, the more it clarifies. That's why we're, in part, brothers and sisters, why we're even having an Ash Wednesday service. It's not simply to embrace a Christian tradition. It's because the Christian tradition has something to enfold us in that's for our good. And so if you come and you want to, we'll place ashes upon your head and say to you, from the dust you came and to the dust you shall return. You know why? Because that's true. And when you believe it, everything changes. You make fewer mistakes. But if I might adapt Dmitri Shostakovich's idea a little bit more, I think that if people began thinking more about resurrection, they'd make fewer foolish mistakes. Like what? Idleness and drivenness, or some cyclical path between them both. How would belief in the resurrection deliver you from either of those two gravitational existential pulls? We probably have to ask ourselves, why do we become idle? Now, I know that for some, idleness equates to doing nothing and never getting up off the couch. But I know you cats well enough to know that that's pretty much none of you, if not any of you. That's not you. I know you're not idle in that way. But I bet this, I bet you're prone to distraction. I bet you're prone to giving your attention to 40 things that you know in the back of your head. Oh, this is really interesting, but I think there's something else I should be doing today. I know that's true about you because I know that's true about me. You're prone to distraction. You know what you're also prone to? You're prone to fear. You are afraid of doing what's hard, of doing what's holy. You know why I know that about you? Because I know that about me. You fear that. And if you are distracted like that, or if you are afraid like that, then yes, guess what? You have a shared experience with those who have an encyclopedic knowledge of every episode of Judge Judy. It's a form of idleness. Fear drives you to idleness in some ways. How then might the resurrection, the doctrine of the resurrection, deliver you from that form of idleness? If the doctrine of resurrection is all about underscoring to you
the beauty, the goodness, the glory of life, then yes, it will console you about death, but I believe it will also transform your idleness into the risk that gives life glory and meaning. Idleness becomes an appetite for risk. Risk for whatever accords with life. Risk to help people find life. Risk to uphold the dignity of every life. Risk to protect a person's life. Risk to be able to point to them who is the author of life. Every one of those is a form of risk. And there's risk in all of that. And because there's risk, there's fear attached to it. And if you follow that fear, you will be distracted. You will be diverted. If you follow that fear, you will walk into the idleness. But if in resurrection we see the glory of life, then idleness is transformed into risk. And, you know, what could go wrong with risk? Everything could go wrong with risk. You could lose everything by taking risk. If the doctrine of resurrection is true, then let it go wrong. Let it go wrong. The doctrine of resurrection has implications for your appetite for risk. That's idleness. That's how it responds to idleness. What about those of us that gets caught in seasons, if not a life of drivenness? Why are we driven? Is it that we like being busy? Yeah. Is it that we like being engaged in a number of things? Sure. And neither of those are problematic. Seize the opportunity. Use what you've got. What's the point? Why do we have all this good stuff, all this good time, all this good energy, if not to expend it, to put it to use? Drivenness, though, is really not about just enjoying busyness. It's really not just about being engaged in a number of things. Drivenness is about trying desperately to matter. Now, we've talked about this recently, and I think I might have even quoted that songwriter Sarah Mason, who said recently, you know, in my 30s, I spent that whole decade trying to learn how to not to matter. Problem is, some of us need to go beyond our 30s in order to keep practicing, in order to keep trying to learn not to matter. Because we use a lot of euphemisms in the way we speak. We say, oh, the drive to achieve, the drive to succeed, the drive to excel. A lot of the times, brothers and sisters, you know what all of that really is? It's the drive to matter. And if you follow that drive, you will be driven. Idleness is often the fear of trying. Drivenness, that's the fear of not getting what you're so desperately trying for. And it'll eat you alive. And it's got a strong gravitational pull. So how does resurrection solve you there? If resurrection rests on reconciliation, and if in that reconciliation we have a relationship with God, then guess what, brothers and sisters? We have, by resurrection, really what we're seeking for in our striving. We have a sense of belonging and of mattering that can never be taken from us. And that's been what's done for us in Christ and His resurrection. He is the one that comes and says to us by dying and rising again, you matter. And when you get that, not only is idleness transformed into risk, drivenness is transformed into rest. There is a rest to be had in realizing that all of your striving is not for the sake so that you can know that you matter, but that your striving actually might be for the purpose for which you set yourself to it. That the work that you're doing is actually for the good of the work, and not because you're also worried that if you don't do it well, that you'll never hear, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." Rest that we already matter. Rest that we already matter to God. Rest that transforms all of our striving. Are you afraid of risk? Do you think that the kind of rest of which I've just spoken is impossible? Can you see that the good news of the God-man snatching life from the jaws of death can free you both to risk and to rest? The creed ends with an amen, which you probably know is the Hebrew word loosely translated as, so be it. Church, so be it.